Please call the case. Good morning to all our counsel, and are you both ready to proceed, Mr. Perkin and Mr. Minkin? Okay. Mr. Perkin, you've reserved 12 minutes for rebuttal, so we'll have the warning light go on with 12 minutes to go, and Mr. Minkin, we'll give you a 10-minute warning. So please proceed. Thank you very much.
Good morning.
Good morning.
And may it please the Honorable Court, we're here again on the Service Charge Statute, 41B-14. This will be, by my senile reckoning, the fourth time that this Honorable Court has been asked to address issues on this. It appears there's been some decision to fight these cases to the death. I think they need to be put to bed so that it doesn't continue to preoccupy and occupy way too much time with regard to this court. And it seems to me that there are two areas that I should probably need to address for it. The first is the Intermediate Court of Appeal decision by Judge Rafer. When I read it, I was extremely surprised because I really believed that Justice McKenna had put those issues to rest. As I understand it, Judge Reifert's opinion, which he actually attempts to support with Villon, says that because in Villon it was decided that the term wages and tips of employees in the second part of the statute meant the same for those purposes as tip income. Therefore, tip income meant the same thing as wages for purposes of the statute generally. And I just, first of all, some very easy distinctions. I'm not going to repeat the wisdom as recited in Villon and Gurabat, which was dismissed in a footnote. But first of all, the statute says, again, paid directly to the employees as tip income. The legislative history of the statute shows that the reason the phrase wages and tips of employees is in there is because of a provision of other law that a certain portion of tips can be regarded as wages for purposes of meeting the minimum wage law. And there was felt, as pointed out in the history, that they didn't want to cause any confusion with that particular statute, as well as having some concern with regard to tax. In this particular instance, the service charge, as it came in, was divided into two parts. There was the service share, and there was the management share. And they called it the management share, and it was theirs to do with as they wanted. In distinction to the server share, which had to be distributed out.
I'm just curious, how long had this practice, how long had this been in the collective bargaining agreement?
Well, I believe that from the beginning of the process of a mandatory service charge, because obviously anyone who is looking out for the interests of the employees would be worried that if the restaurant, hotel, charge what they call a mandatory service charge, that would be regarded as a gratuity by the customers, and unless the servers got a decent portion of it, they would be left out in the cold. So it was agreed that the hotels would charge a minimum service charge. They were given a mandatory minimum, and the employees would get 85% of that. Now, as in the Kahala case, the employer, the hotel, was free to add more on top of that minimum service charge, and indeed, in the Kahala case, the Kahala tacked on an extra 1%, which was also part of their funds, and it was their money. And
so it preceded the 451B14. It was before 2000 that this was in the collective bargaining agreement?
I'm not going to make that representation to you, Justice McKenna. I believe that to be the case, but I am not positive.
Was the collective bargaining agreement renewed at some point after 41B14 was?
Yes, it was.
In your view, is there any? Yeah. What is the effect of the fact that there was a negotiated approach to how these funds would be distributed? Any effect at all in terms of how the statute applies, or none whatsoever?
I think there's no effect on how the statute applies, because there's nothing in the collective bargaining agreement that says that they don't have to make the disclosure necessary under Hawaii law. They don't otherwise have to obey Hawaii law. What the provision of the collective bargaining agreement is there for is a safety net.
Can the agreement trump the statute in any event?
No, I don't believe it could, but I don't think there's no evidence that they tried. And it would be perfectly easy for the hotel to comply with both. That's all they had to do. And I don't think that going into it, anyone on the union side thought that they were authorizing or trying to authorize the hotel to violate that statute or to violate the law.
Mr. Perkins, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but could you help me with this distinction that the intermediate court was making? You mentioned footnote 5, where Gorobot is discussed, and I think that in that instance, the intermediate court felt that it was an important distinction between the facts in Gorobot and our case, that the income that was paid, that is the portion of the income that was derived from the service fee, the portion that was paid for purposes of wages was to supplement the income of managerial employees as opposed to employees that in this case might perhaps be covered by 481B14 in the sense that they were non-managerial.
Actually, I believe if you look at the testimony of Carl Markle, which is in the record in this particular case, which is here's in docket number 76, the trial testimony, you will see that, and I would particularly direct your attention to pages 4, line 49, and all the way through to page 29, line 5. What they were doing was a bookkeeping entry. The management share was separated from the employees' gratuity share and held until the next payment pay cycle, wages and salaries. And that money went to offset their wage and salary obligation. With salary people in there, they're not even hourly workers. They nowhere fall into any classification as being, you know, tipped employees. As I said, it was bookkeeping. They could have, as Ms. Markham testified, they could have just used it to offset linens. They could have used it to offset repair costs.
So your position is that, in fact, the payment that was being made wasn't being made to just non-management employees necessarily because of the nature of the bookkeeping?
I believe that There are management employees because there were managers, banquet managers, and of course, the people in non-banquet departments, I mean, the catering department, and others who had no direct hand in providing any banquet services whatsoever were included. So it was managers, it included salaried employees. But first and foremost, I guess it's this, the point that got Judge Chang down below, and I, where a place where I thought he got it absolutely right, was that management share was the hotel's to do with whatever they wanted. And it was not and never was paid directly to employees as tip income, as the statute provides. And they could have, I suppose, paid it directly, but they never did. They took the money, they held it, they used it as an offset for their accounting purposes against their payroll account. And I think that that's a way far field.
So following your line of thought, then, it could have been used for costs and expenses as well.
I'm sorry?
Following your line of thought, then, that fund could have been used for cost and expenses as well, theoretically?
Yes, well, actually, well, it's hopefully it'll never, that one will never get in front of you folks. It turned out that the Hilton Hawaiian Village was doing exactly that. They're using part of it to buy glasses and napkins and tablecloths. It's up to the hotel how it wants to use that money because it's its share. It belongs to them from the get-go.
What if the hotel collectively bargained with the employees, 85% would go to them as gratuity and 15% would go directly to them in partial satisfaction of their wages? Would that be okay or not okay in your view?
Well, interesting. First of all, management employees being included in the mix, they're people that aren't, they're not union members, they're non-union. So I don't know how you get into including them in some scheme based upon the collective bargaining agreement. As I said, the hotel can legally, theoretically, use its share for anything that it wants to use. The point is, if it's not going to pay it to the servers as to income, they have to disclose that.
Did the money go to management as just to help the hotel pay management, the salaried employees, or did it go to salaried employees as bonuses?
Actually, the first.
I thought in this case it went to the tipped employees as wages. I thought that was the issue here. It was basically bookkeeping. It was creative bookkeeping. But in order to try to comply with the statute, what they did was take 15%, call it management shares, applied it to wages. But the issue is, under the consumer protection statutes, it's the consumer, we who go to these banquets thinking that 100% of what's called the service fee is going to the wait help, and it's not, right? And so the issue here is, what's the percentage? Could they have done 50%? Could they have done 85% the other way and say, you know what, we're going to take, collectively bargain that we're going to take 50%, we'll apply it through our bookkeeping to your wages. You know, under the collective bargaining agreement or whatever. I don't know if that was part of the collective bargaining agreement or this is just something that they decided to do to try to comply with the statute. But the point being is that if they had negotiated for 50%, the consumer who's going to get the banquet thinks that the 19% or whatever is going as tips, and it's not. It might be applied to their hourly wages, but it's not going to them. Isn't that the issue here?
No, actually, Justice McKenna, the deal is really worse than that. Because the deal is that it is the server's share that can, in part, be used as wages to satisfy the minimum wage. The management share is going to a completely different set of employees. And indeed, number of whom are not tipped, our management, our salary.
They could have, but it was their policy and practice, as the ICA says, to allocate its management share as a bookkeeping offset against wages owed to the relevant employees, who are the tipped employees in this case.
Ah, but then again, if you look at Kara Markham's testimony is found in the here we go, in docket number 76, they were defining relevant employees as convention planning staff.
Oh, so they were including management. It wasn't just the tipped employees.
Exactly.
Okay. All right.
They expanded the definition out to the maximum.
Okay.
And you hit on an interesting point. If you read Ms. Markham's testimony, I think you will see that what they were doing was rather thoughtfully designed to attempt to evade the statute rather than comply with it. So I don't think this is a case of innocent ignorance. I mean, they thought, hey, we can get away with this. I think the answer is they can't.
Let me ask you something. The statute says that a hotel that applies a service charge shall distribute the service charge. And what I focused on was the word distribute. Now, the word distribute means to give out, deliver, apportion, divide, those kinds of words. I couldn't find a definition that says retention, offset. So I don't understand how, if you are offsetting wages, that conforms to the requirement of distribute.
I couldn't agree with you more, Justice Pollack. I think that's absolutely correct. It doesn't work. And the directly, they're obligated to give the employee's tip income share directly to the employees. And they have to do that every cycle. I mean, they have to do that promptly. And it is paid directly. The other money, and I think directly is as important as distributed, Justice Pollack, because I don't think by putting it in another account and holding it and then transferring it to an account for payroll, that that's distributing it directly. And it's certainly not distributing it directly as tip income, because it's going to people who aren't tipped. They aren't in the tip pool. They aren't in that category of employees, servers get tipped.
And in fact, by their bookkeeping, as I see it, they don't even distribute. They just offset it.
That's right. That's exactly what they do.
And in fact, what they could have done is just said, look, we're just going to deduct it, period, which apparently is what they do. I mean, it seems to be a complete end run about the legislative intent to have this distributed to their employees.
Mr. Perkins, can you, following up on what Justice Pollack said, the intermediate court seems to acknowledge just what you're saying, that the entire amount of the service charge could be withheld by the hotel and paid for wages, and that unfortunately that would create somewhat of a tension, I guess, with the legislature's intent. But the point, I think, of the ICA is that needs to be attended to by the legislature, right? So how would you respond to that interpretation of the legislative history?
Justice Wilson, I would actually tell them, first of all, why don't you go back and carefully read the Billon and the Girlbach cases, because I believe they deal with that issue. I think it's an artificial confusion. And frankly, that's, as I said, I don't believe that Judge Reifer's conclusion that because the term wages and tips is in there as with regard to the last part of the statute, that it means that tip income is synonymous with wages. I mean, it makes no sense to me. I don't believe, it's not perhaps the most artfully drafted statute I'm not going to criticize because I haven't tried to write one, but this, I believe, this issue's clear. Now, I don't want to go into my rebuttal time too deeply, but The other issue, and key, and the reason why we're here on appeal in the first place, is were there any damages? And while Judge Chang, I think, got it dead right on the issue of this, the interpretation of the statute with regard to how they were diverting part of it, the issue of no damages. There was no out-of-pocket loss. You can't fight that, because what could the out-of-pocket loss be? They agreed to pay X bucks to get a banquet, and they paid X bucks and they got a banquet. But the problem is that they were deceived as to where part of that money was going. And when they are deceived out of money, I believe, and Justice Padgett in the Lieber case, who first laid it out, that
Is this the JNOV issue? Are we now? Was this issue raised in your CERDAP? I guess would be the question I have.
I don't think so.
Well, that's an interesting question.
Just reading the question presented in your CERT application, whether the IC gravely erred when it held a hotel that fails to distribute 100%, fails to disclose it to customers, is nevertheless complying with 41B14 if the hotel is reclassifying this money and making an accounting adjustment crediting the retained service charge against its pre-existing wage and salary obligation. So that was a question presented in the CERT app.
So this court, reversing those particular points, we go back to the Intermediate Court of Appeals for resolution of the other issues.
At the moment, we only have what's in front of us. I guess we have what's in front of us, so we'll have to decide what the appropriate disposition is depending on how we rule on these issues. But those are what we had in the CERT app.
My bad.
No, thank you.
Thank you, Chief Justice. Thank you, Justices. What we have is a very interesting situation because we have a consumer fraud case. That's what Kawakami is, not an employee fraud case like Davis Gorobot of Milan. And we have the Kahala attempting to understand a statute before those cases came down, before those cases gave some clarity, put some meat on the bones, as it were, to what's out there. And what we have is a situation where there were basically cross motions for partial summary judgment before Judge Chang, and Judge Chang deleted part of the statute. And he deleted that part of the statute that says you need to clearly disclose to the purchaser of the services that the service charge is being used for to pay for costs or expenses other than wages and tips. Basically gave no meaning whatsoever, considered wages and basically surplusage, because that's what plaintiffs argue, that you have to knock it out. So what do we have? We have a situation where we have a hotel that, and let me just jump back to a question that Justice Paul asked about distribute, because service charges, they come in cash, they come in checks, they come in charge cards. What happens? In this particular case, all the service charges went into a single account. That single account was distributed based upon the collective bargaining agreement twice a month, every 2 weeks, as tip income, and then at the end of the month, applied to wages. And my recollection is a little bit different than Mr. Perkin regarding what Kara Markham testified. My recollection is she testified that the wages went to waged employees.
But how is that distributed if you give something to somebody and then you take it back? I mean, the fact that they took the 15% and didn't give it to their employee and then took it back from them, how can that be distributed? Or is that distributed with a condition subsequent that it comes back to the employer?
Well, the statute says if it's used to pay for something other than wages and tips.
Oh, I see. You're going to the second subsection.
So you go to the second section, okay. Right? You have to do that. And what do we know? We know in the questions from Justice McKenna and Chief Justice, for how long has the collective bargaining agreement been in effect? Well, the collective bargaining agreement for my clients predated their purchase of the hotel. What else do we know? We know from the legislative testimony that Unite 5 testified, the union. We know that ILWU testified and had some concerns, and DLIR from the state testified. So all of these folks that have literally the hands-on, Unite 5 is the collective bargaining agreement, and there were subsequent agreements that were amended over time, but the percentage, 85%, that never changed. That remained the same.
So I don't see anything in your briefs where you're arguing that the collective bargaining agreement supersedes the statute.
No. Okay. And I mean, we talked about it down below with Judge Chang, but at this point in time, I don't believe that a contract supersedes a statute. The statute is there. But the purpose of the statute was to protect employees. The employees are also protected by their union. And the union negotiated the collective bargaining agreement fully aware of the statute and its obligations.
But Mr. Mencken, it's really, I don't think anybody is saying that, at least I don't look at it as your client did anything, you know, under, you know, trickery or anything. I understand that they were following, but well, we have a statute that trumps whatever the bargaining agreement is. So this is not a matter of pointing blame.
No, but I think if you look at the statute and give the statute its full intent and meaning, you can't wipe out the second clause of the statute.
Okay, let's look at the second clause, because the way I read that statute, there's two alternatives that the statute gives you, okay? One, you pay it, you distribute it as wages or income. You give it to the, and that wasn't done, at least if the word distributed has the meaning of the question that I asked. The second alternative says you have to disclose it if it's being used in a different way other than wages and tips. But you didn't satisfy other than wages and tips because you weren't distributing it as other than wages and tips. So you only have those two alternatives. There's not a third alternative in this statute, and that I think is what your argument is. You're trying to create a third alternative that if it somehow is being taken from your wages and tips, then the third alternative, you don't have to disclose anything. That's your argument.
It's being paid as part of the wages.
It's being deducted.
It's being used as an accounting concept. The hotel has to pay per the collective bargaining agreement.
Wait, I thought that was voluntarily. It was just your client's own policy. There's nothing in the collective bargaining agreement that says where that 15% management share goes to.
Correct. The hotel has to pay 85%. Based on the collective bargaining agreement, it has to pay a certain amount in wages. And it's using this 15%, not as other venues did, to buy other things. It's using to pay its wage obligations based upon the collective bargaining agreement.
But it was not obligated to do so by the collective bargaining agreement. It was not obligated to use this money for that purpose, correct?
Absolutely. But the reality is, looking at the statute, wages and tips, what does that mean? What does that mean? And yes, that results in a conundrum that the ICA talked about and obviously troubles some of you. How does that work its way through?
It works its way through, I think, by, I think Villon made it, Villon, it is because of the, because some can be considered wages for enforcement under 388.6, but I think Gurobot made it fairly clear that, and I think I respectfully disagree with your position that this 481B14 is to protect the employee. It is a consumer protection statute, and I think Gurobot made it very clear that the purpose of it's for the consumers, that when we go to the banquets, we are confident that the people that are waiting on us are getting that full amount as tip. And if we don't, because we want to make sure that they're adequately tipped. And that's the issue here. And so it is a consumer protection statute.
No,
it's not an employee protection statute.
It started out, though, as a wage and hour thing dealing with employees.
Right.
And through its various deviations, it ended up in the consumer protection statute.
Right. And it appears fairly clear here. And then I think Gorbat made it very clear that 100% has to be distributed as tips. And if not, if it's 100% is not distributed as tips, you have to tell the consumer. I think that's what Gorbat stands for.
And along with Justice McKenna's point, Mr. Mencken, would you concede then that your analysis would support the footnote that I mentioned, paragraph in footnote 7, that said that theoretically then all the service charges could be used to pay wages? And if that's the case, isn't that directly contrary to the legislative intent in that 2000 Senate journal?
I think, you know, the footnote is there's a reason it's a footnote, because it deals with hypotheticals, it deals with potential situations. But for my client, we're not dealing in that potential situation, and I would agree that in the abstract, that's potentially possible. But in reality, that's not what took place. And I think that's what we need to focus on. We need to focus on both aspects of the statute, what was necessary, and I agree with Justice McKenna that, yes, it is a consumer protection statute when it reached what it did at the end of the day. The reality is that, and granted that the other cases dealt with employees and they have their own rights and they can proceed however they wish based upon the prior decisions, but I think we have to look at what the Kahala was looking at and what they were faced with, and basically looking at a plain reading of the statute. Look at the statute. Does it make sense? Were they on notice that they couldn't do what they were doing? And how do they have that particular notice to tell them prior to Davis, prior to Gurabat, Vilan, prior to Gurabat, how do they know that? And they basically relied upon their interpretation, and even the trial court recognized that their interpretation was very understandable based upon the law, but disagreed with their interpretation, but understood the dilemma that they faced, because it was a law that came into effect 2000. It's something out there, and as the court knows, it's basically affected a number of entities, of business entities throughout the state, not just here on law. How do you get there? How do you have that knowledge that what you were doing was improper until the Supreme Court comes down and clarifies their interpretation of the statute? And that, to me, is the biggest problem, because looking at it on its face, other than wages and tips, they paid it as 85% as tips and the other 15% as something now being referred to as offsetting, what calculated against, but wages for their employees. How do you get there? That's the problem. So
I'm sorry.
Go ahead. No. Doesn't the statute still require clearly disclose? What's ambiguous about that?
Clearly disclose if it's being used for other than wages and tips.
Right.
So from Kahala's perspective, it was being used for wages and tips. It was paying wages and tips. 85% pursuant to the collective bargaining agreement, that other portion, that 15%, was now going to pay for the wages.
So you dispute what Mr. Perkins said, that part of it was used to pay the salaried employees?
I don't remember that testimony from Ms. Martin. I don't have it in front of me at the moment, but I don't remember that testimony. So what do we have in this situation? We have a case where we have a hotel that's attempting to comply with the statute, that it now, based upon renderings by this court, potentially puts their obligations in another category, or explains to them that they may have not fully complied. But that gets us back to, what do we have? Is this an ambiguous statute? Is this statute something that needs to be rectified by the legislature, as Justice Wilson indicated, because there's something that this court can't do, and this court knows that it can't legislate. So how do we reconcile what took place? And I believe that the ICA decision reconciles it. It doesn't give us comfort 100%, but it tells us what took place, why it took place, in following this court's rulings in Milan and Gurabat.
Doesn't the ICA decision again stand for the proposition then that if it's collectively bargained, that, you know, it could have been the other way? It could have been 90% for wages and then 10% for tips, and wouldn't that obliterate the legislative intent of 481B14? I think legislative intent is pretty clear. The legislature wanted all of it to be distributed as tip income, and if it's not going to be, that the consumer be told about it.
I don't think if by looking at it and going back to the legislative history, how do you give meaning to other than wages and tips?
Because it's not being used for wages. It's being used to offset wages and tips. I can't see how the difference could be greater. You're using it to distort the legislation, not you specifically, but that the definition to interpret other than wages and tips to be interpreted so that it can be used to offset, to reduce that what the person would be getting. In other words, you could take every single dollar that the person would be entitled to get and just say, well, sorry, that comes off your minimum wage. How does that conform with what the legislature was trying to do with this statute?
If you go back, before it ended up in this section, what was it worried about? It was worried about money being paid to basically servers, and not just in hotels that are covered by union contracts, collective bargaining agreements, but any venue where there's banquets or functions being held. And here's where I get to my own background. I spent 15 years in restaurants and hotels. The minimum wage that was being paid in certain establishments was absolutely unbelievable. It was so far below. And the reality is that when, for this particular client, Kahala, it's subject to a collective bargaining agreement. So is this the type of category of employees that the statute initially started to try to protect? And I don't know if it is. Or is the legislature basically starting out to try to protect people in smaller establishments that don't pay full wages, that don't do the tips, that do the tip sharing amongst everybody, or the management keeps it? So we have to look at reality.
Mr. Minkin, your argument in a sense speaks strongly to the other side, because this statute doesn't say if you're Kahala and you're under collective bargaining, we're going to have exception. It's applying it across the board.
No,
to protect people just like you, apparently, who is getting lesser minimum wage. I mean, it's
correct. No, I understand that. That's why I think you have to give import other than wages and tips, because the unions testify at different points during the statute.
Villan made it very clear that the reason that wages was included in the second part was for enforcement, was for the purpose of calculating the tip credit, as Mr. Perkin has pointed out. That's why that word was in there. Okay, but Villan is very clear, as well as Gurovat is very clear, that you have to distribute 100% as tips. And if you don't do it, you have to disclose. Otherwise, I am very confused by your argument, in the sense that you seem to be suggesting that it would be fine for there to be a collective bargaining agreement, that it was 50-50 or whatever, and basically the employees would only get 7.5% tips when the consumer's thinking they're getting 15%, whatever it is. Anyway, I think the law is fairly clear, Mr. Minkin.
Mr. Minkin, I was trying to think of if you had put on your disclosure, please be advised that every dollar that you tip, or whatever it is, or every percentage is going, we're keeping. That's what should have been on there. We're going to use it to offset the minimum wage. Maybe that would have been the disclosure.
I'm going to end at this point. If there's any other questions, given the comments from the court, I don't wish to belabor my belief as to what the statute means, given the comments from the various justices in the CJ.
I'm just going to ask one thing, and I want to be fair to Mr. Perkin. I read Mr. Perkin's question in his cert app. I do note that in the conclusion of his cert application, the plaintiff suggests that this court should reverse the ICA's opinion, vacate the judgment in favor of KHI, reinstate the jury verdict, and remand the case for limited purpose of trebling damages. So if I understand correctly, the cert app, although not identifying the merits of the damages issue or providing any argument, suggests that this court should reach that issue. What would your position be with regard to that if this court were to resolve the threshold question regarding the disclosure against your client?
I think it has to go back. Thank you for the question, because that was a note that we had written. I think it has to go back to the ICA to determine the other issues, such as where damages, was there liability, was there damages, did they prove the damages? It has to go back to the ICA. It just can't basically go back to the trial court and vacate the trial court's decision, because that's never been given full play by the Intermediate Court of Appeal.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And Mr. Perkin, I'll ask that same question of you. I didn't anything different or anything to add in view of that portion of your CERDAP or not?
Well, frankly, Mr. Chief Justice, if I felt falling to my knees and begging would do any good, and I thank you profoundly for being smarter than I am to pick that up. I think it's a waste of time for this court to have to keep going back and forth on this statute. As I said, this is the fourth time we've had to have it.
Mr. Perkin, but it wasn't briefed to us.
It's in the briefs that are part of and attached to the cert petition.
But has it been addressed by either counsel? Has Mr. Mencken been given proper notice to address it?
And, you know, that's fair. And, of course, he should get proper notice. But the one thing, just to help him out, to be fair, because he couldn't remember that there was anything about salaried employees getting part of the management share. If you look at docket number 76 and specifically focus on text from page 24 from lines 14 to 25, I said, okay, then you're talking about pay as wages. And as I understand it, that covers salaried employees. Am I correct? The banquet department would include a couple of managers that are salaried. So in fact, it is used for salaried employees. And when they say banquet department, they include departments, as she goes on to explain, have nothing to do with serving a particular event. They are involved in all kinds of other administrative tasks. So I think that part of it is clear. And if there are no further questions, I thank you very much for your courtesy.
Thank you very much to both of our counsel here today. The court will take this matter under advisement. Thank you.